What's the good, Dadcast Nation? I'm your boy Lavelle, coming at you with the Dadcast Podcast. And we've got a treat for you today, man. We are talking to one of the top 50 greatest rappers of all time, according to Billboard Records. He's no stranger to those that are watching out of Houston, but those of you that are watching from around the world, you might know about him and you might not, but if you don't, you will know about him after this episode. He's an entrepreneur. He has been a professor. He's an author. He's an actor. And as I mentioned, he is a rap legend from the group UGK, the one and only Bun B.
Lavelle, thank you for having me, bro.
All right, man. Appreciate you being here. I want to get right into it, but before I get into it, I got to tell you guys a story. Because it speaks to the kind of brother this dude is. I was at the Waffle House and I was giving my card and something was wrong with the machine or whatever, it wasn't working. And I hear this voice in the back of me saying, "I got you." And I turned around. Well, I didn't turn around right away. I was telling the lady that, you know, the card should be good or whatever. She re-ran it. And I turned around and it was Bun. And that just kind of speaks to the kind of guy he is. That we don't run into that every day when we talk to, you know, when we talk about celebrities and people that people look up to. Everybody doesn't have that credibility like that. So I appreciate you for that, man.
You'd be surprised, man. A lot of people do a lot and they just don't say nothing.
Yeah.
And that's just like how I move. I don't have to broadcast everything I do.
Right.
You know, you see something good you could do for somebody and you just do it. You know, you don't need no applause and nobody patting you on the back for doing something good. Just do it and go on about your business.
Yeah, for real, for real. But that was my introduction to him. Of course, I've been following his music all the way back since the 90s, when before UGK came out. As a matter of fact, I heard that you had a previous rap name before you became Bun B, and it's something to do with the comics.
Yeah, yeah, Shadow Storm.
Shadow Storm.
First rap name. You know what I'm saying? I just wanted to have some kind of different type of name, but it didn't work. It didn't last long. You can't really build a career off of some kind of name like that, you know. It ain't nothing for people to really get into. But not to say that Bun B is easier, but it just, that one ended up making a lot more sense.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Because at the time, everybody had like an initial, like Jimmy J and Teddy T and all that type of stuff. So mine was Bun. First it was Bunny B, and then we was like, no, we're going to do Bun B. But that was my partner, Sharan Thomas from Port Arthur.
Okay. And he mentioned Port Arthur. We both come out of the same city. I think, Bun, you were born here in Houston, though, right?
Yeah, born in Houston. And my parents divorced in the fifth grade, so I moved to Port Arthur the summer before my sixth grade year.
Okay. And I was born in Englewood and then moved to Port Arthur when I was young. And I had heard about you, you know, of course, even before you guys, when I was at Lincoln going to Summit, and we had guys, Charles Freeman and guys like that, we were all trying to rap, and they was like, "They got this little young kid named Bun that's real dope and all this." And so I've been hearing about you, and then of course when UGK came out, we were just like, you know, that set us on the map. You put PA right on the map.
We just wanted to rap for the town, you know.
Yeah. So PA roots, out of Houston, PA roots.
West side,
huh? Yeah. All right. And then UGK, tell me about, and tell our audience, those that don't know, how was UGK born?
UGK was born out of Port Arthur, Texas. It was a collection of brothers who came together at the time. Originally, the original institution of UGK was started with Chad and his brother Mitchell Queen.
Okay.
I was in another group with this brother named Jalon Jackson. That we all ended up rapping together, and then Jalon and Mitch moved on towards football because Mitch had a scholarship to Prairie View. So he ended up deciding to go and play football. And then Jalon was trying to get a scholarship. So it ended up being a situation where Chad was like, "Well, I want to do this music stuff." And I was like, "I think I want to give it a try too." And so, you know, we let it be known we were looking to put some music out, and we had recorded, you know, different songs around the town. Ended up going to King's Flea Market to Big Time Records, and they said they were looking for artists. We went back to PA, got the demo, came back to Houston to the flea market, gave him the demo. He checked it out, and he liked the song on there called "Tell Me Something Good," and he ended up signing us, and that's what we went with.
Okay. Now, did you and Chad know each other since you moved to Port Arthur? Or?
No. I mean, I knew of Chad, you know, because of his family. His mom was a librarian. You know, his dad was the choir director. So you kind of knew who Chad was. And mm-hmm. then as he started making music, because, you know, Chad and guys like Dory and Mitch, these were some of the people in the city making music. Dory Dorsey.
Right.
DJ DMD. DJ, who y'all know is DJ DMD. 25 Lighters. And so, you know, if you were into rap music at the time, which everybody wasn't, you would know who Chad was. And Mitch was a classmate. Me and Mitch was both in class of 91.
Okay.
So I knew Mitch very well, but I didn't know Chad well. And eventually I got to know Chad and we became real close because we were, everybody, you know, said they wanted to do music, but then they came up to a point where you had to decide if you was going to do music or if you was going to do something else.
Right.
And we decided to do music. You know, and I guess the rest is history.
Yeah, good history too. Legendary history. I remember, man, like most people watching that have, you know, followed UGK from the beginning, I remember exactly where I was, what I was doing the moment that I got news that Chad had passed away. I was working at the Port of Long Beach. I was in my office looking over the ocean. And somebody called me and they were like, Pimp passed. And I was like, nah, that can't be real. And I know for you, man, that had to be like a life-altering moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this was somebody that, you know, we went through a lot together that many people wouldn't understand. Like everybody, you know, might understand rap music and all that type of stuff, but they don't really understand the things that you have to go through in life. And not just with rap music, but in period. In general, to succeed. And there was a lot of shit that Chad and I went through together. We weathered a lot of shit, you know. And it hurt me deeply at first, initially for my loss. But then I had to step back and look at, you know, as bad as I'm hurting. You know, his mom was hurting more. His kids are hurting more. His wife is hurting more. These fans, these people that love him, they're hurting as well. So, you know, at that point, you know, I had to kind of push how I felt to the side for a little while, but then eventually it started becoming, you know, overwhelming. I went through a period of depression. And, you know, it was just a very rough time in my life, but I realized that in order to keep his legacy alive, I would have to get back on it, you know?
Right.
So, you know, thank God I got a good wife and a strong support system at home to, you know, keep me focused on what I need to do.
Right, right. Now, I was going to catch this later in the podcast, but I want to segue right into it right now because you brought up a very serious topic. You talked about depression, and I want to talk about mental health, but specifically how Black men deal with it. You know, I've been around a lot of people all across the country. I was in the Army, met a lot of people from different countries, and you know, when it comes to suppressing our feelings, our emotions as Black men, a lot of times we've been taught don't cry, you know, got to have a hard exterior, you know, you got to hold it up and all this kind of stuff. And man, I learned quickly that that's not always the case. We got to deal with those emotions. What are your feelings on that?
Well, look, man, anything that you don't deal with, it will eventually come out. And the longer you take to deal with it, the more of an explosive situation it could potentially be. You know, a lot of us were raised to suppress these feelings and suppress these emotions and keep them inside. Man up. You know, a lot of us heard man up, men don't cry, and shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reality is that the men that raised us were not allowed socially to show those type of things. They had to keep up a strong appearance in the face of, you know, Jim Crow and discrimination and racism and all these type of things. They had to keep their head up. But we live in a time now that even though we still deal with these things, there are outlets and it's not as taboo as it used to be. You know, you don't have to be strong or you don't have to present yourself as stronger than you really are. And, right. You know, if you're dealing with something, it's not something you got to tell everybody either. But get some help for it. Tell somebody.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You don't have to walk around carrying a sign saying I have mental health issues, but you need to be talking to somebody about it because nobody can handle any problem really on their own. Everybody needs help with something at some point. And there are people to help you. There are outlets to help you, but you got to let people know that you need help. We hear it all the time. All the time, a quiet mouth don't get fed.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But no, don't be scared. There's got to be somebody that you know close to you that you can talk to about these things that you don't feel will compromise you and take advantage of you by knowing this information. You know, I would always tell people to start with their pastor. Go to, you know, well, first of all, if your parents, you talk to your parents if you can. If not, go to a pastor. And if not a pastor, some big brother, uncle, or whoever a father figure is might be in your life. But you got to talk to somebody about this stuff. Or a woman, if you feel more comfortable talking to a woman about what you're going through. You know, right. Go to your mama, go to your aunties, go to, you know, one of the elders in the church. But don't sit on this type of shit. All it does is just build up inside of you. And when you do try to deal with it, it might come out the wrong way at the wrong time, in the wrong place. And now other people may have to suffer, or you may have to suffer in other areas in your life, like at your job or in your relationship, because you didn't address it the right way.
Yeah, that's real. You know, we all deal with that. Me and my boy Ruck, who's here in the studio, we talked about that a lot, about, you know, just letting, being there for our brothers and letting them know that we, you know, we down with them no matter what's going on, good, bad, the ugly. And just being straight with people, like, you know, having a bad day, you having a bad day. It's just the way it is. But everybody don't deal with it like that. You guys are hearing it from what many people would consider one of the hardest dudes in the world.
We all go through things.
Yeah. That's real talk, and that's what we need in our community. Is to really just, you know, be open, be transparent, deal with stuff like that. So another thing I wanted to talk about is hip-hop and religion. So you were at Rice University, right?
Yeah.
Are you still teaching there? Or are you
not right now? I haven't taught since before COVID. And when we do go back in, we're going to reframe the class. It won't be what it was. Okay. It'll still be in that area, but we're looking to go in a different, slightly different direction with the class.
Okay. And it was hip-hop and world religion?
It was hip-hop and religion. It was a humanities course. So it wasn't a music course. It was actually a religious course at Rice University.
All right. So that brings me to the next topic I want to cover. I remember when UGK was real hot, because I, back in the 90s, talking about Mitchell Queen, I was at Paul Queen's church, his uncle. And I was a youth pastor over there and that kind of stuff. And man, like, a lot of people I knew in the church were not like supporting UGK music. Matter of fact, I think I remember hearing stuff about some protests taking place.
Yeah,
some of y'all said
that was in the very early days of UGK. That was when Pocketful of Stones was a real hot record, and many people automatically assumed that it was glamorizing drug life. But if you look, it's really kind of a tale about how ugly the cycle is, because once you get in that world, it's very hard for you to get out of that world. And if you do get out of that world, you're really not left with a skill set that could be used for much more.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? If you don't figure out how to transition into some type of legitimate business while you're doing it, you probably won't go into a legitimate business after you're doing it. You know what I'm saying? You have to go into these things with a mindset of some type of end game, where you do something with the money you make and use it for something else. That's typically how crime families and organizations run. You know what I'm saying? We use dirty money to fund clean business. Mm-hmm. But if that's not your mindset going into it, then it probably won't be your mindset coming out of it. And your whole lifestyle would be built around perpetuating that particular thing. And when you do end up doing it, it's because you have to, not because you want to. You know what I'm saying? Either people get jammed up, you lose your plug, or you get jammed up. Right. You know what I'm saying? So if you don't go into it with the idea of, we need to hustle to get this bread, so we can do this and go somewhere else, which is, you know, kind of the mindset that we apply, you know what I'm saying? Like, we all want to do this. We're going to do this with the mindset of getting enough money to do this so that we don't have to do that anymore.
Right. Yeah. So it was kind of a means to an end.
Yeah, yeah. Just a matter of getting from A to B.
All right. So, because you never strike me as the stereotypical drug dealer kind of guy. Like, you just don't come across like that. But
no, the good drug dealer never comes across is that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's, you know, the good drug dealer ain't the dude with the big fancy car and a bunch of jewelry. He's the dude walking around with, like, you ever see them old dudes driving around in their truck with their overalls on and shit that? That's what the plug really look like. People like that. The plug ain't necessarily who people think they look like. They're dudes that have been hustling 20, 30 years. You know what I'm saying? But have always been very low key and quiet about who they are. Now the people that need to know who they are.
Right.
But the people that don't need to know will never know who they are unless somebody that knows them compromises them. But generally the real plug pretty much stays in position.
Right. I remember I used to talk to Pastor Queen all the time about like the people I knew wouldn't come to church in a suit. Like they would, if I invited them to the church, they would never come in a suit because that just wasn't how they dressed. That wasn't how they lived.
Right.
And so I learned over the years through a lot of trial and error that you just got to be relatable to people. And when we talk about hip hop, and of course we're celebrating 50 years of hip hop this year. When we talk about hip hop, is there a place for religion in the hip hop community?
Absolutely, particularly in the South and in the East Coast, because a lot of their rap music comes from places of deep spiritual thought. A lot of people from the South grew up in the church. A lot of the music that we draw from has that type of church influence. When we make songs or write songs, a lot of them come with chants and anthems, people me saying something, them saying something back. There's a lot of dynamics that exist in the church in terms of practices and communication with people that exists within music, but specifically within hip hop music. As people understand now the level of conversation you can have with the people listening to your music and it presented the right way, people can actually receive it the way you want it to be received. It allows people to be more open with who they are and how they feel.
Right.
Some of that could be a good thing when it comes to religion and world outlooks and helping your fellow man, and some of it can be in a bad way where, Kanye West. So, at one point, Kanye was comfortable enough to talk about Jesus, which most people did not feel comfortable talking about Jesus that were that famous.
Right.
On that big of a stage. But that same confidence made him feel comfortable enough to talk about being a Nazi and all this other type of stuff. So, entertainment and having people support you and look up to you and build you up can be empowering, but power itself can corrupt. So you just have to be careful about what's given to you and just be honest and as human as possible. That's what I try to do, is try to keep the wall away, putting up a wall between people. Me, you see me in Waffle House in the morning, one deep by myself, I'm just trying to get some breakfast like everybody else. I don't look at the dynamic between me and the people that support me and listen to my music from a me up here, them down here. It's a we here together.
That's amazing to me because I was trying to figure out why in the hell nobody knew Bun B in Waffle House when I went
there. It's not that they don't know. They used to see me. I go over there all the time. So at that location, ain't nobody going to
really trip there. After he walked out, I'm looking around like, why ain't y'all not saying that? That was Bun
B. It was probably
like,
a Sunday, right?
Yeah.
Typically on Sundays, you catch me up there. So they ain't tripping no more. Used to be a thing, but most of the people that go to that Waffle House on Sunday go almost every Sunday.
Right.
So they like, oh, there go B, what's up, B? And drink their coffee and know about their business.
Yeah, that was interesting. But I like what you said, though, man, because it makes you, we were just talking about it before you came in, like a man among the people. Like it's not like you didn't roll in here tonight with 20 deep or nothing like that. You came in here by yourself, and you just a relatable dude.
It's been 30 years. If you talk about it being 50 years of hip hop, this is my 31st year of being in the business. And so I don't walk with it like that. It's not a new suit.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I'm not coming out in a new suit every day. These are my gym clothes.
I got you. That's dope. So 50 years of hip hop, man. We did a live when we were in Minneapolis a few weeks ago, when we were talking about going through, 50 years of hip hop. And I remember so vividly, like when the first time I heard Rapper's Delight and had 78 on the wall and put my 45s up there and all that kind of stuff and dressed up my room. I just remembered like it was yesterday. When did you know that hip hop was it for you? Like, has that been something in you since the very beginning? You just always loved music? Do you like different genres of music?
I've always loved music in general. Hip hop really spoke to me. But I was really just a fan of it, really just trying to absorb as much of the culture as I could. So, you know, I rapped, I would break dance a little bit, but I can't write or draw, so I couldn't do graffiti. And I didn't have the best hand-eye coordination. I could barely break dance. So DJing just really wasn't something that I gravitated to or felt like I had a natural gift of doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll be honest, it wasn't until I saw people rapping that I was like, shit, if they can rap, I can rap. Because I thought you had to be from somewhere or at least have some type of special talent or whatever. And, you know, like I said, I would see Chad and Mitch and, Nahala Johnson, who is now known as Mr. Boomtown,
okay.
You know, legendary yeah. music video director, feature film director. You know, he was one of the first people rapping in my hometown. So watching people like that actually write rhymes and make music, I was like, wait a minute. So, you know, almost anybody can rap. Like, if you want to rap, you can rap. So I said, fuck it, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring too, you know? And I, again, like I said earlier, I had a terrible name, wrote terrible rhymes, but really wanted to be good at it. And so I put a lot of time and effort to it. And I believe in, you know, in my little time period, I don't think anybody wanted it as bad as I did. I don't think anybody worked as hard for it as I did. And I continue to do that to this day. That's why I'm still rapping with, you know, young artists, old artists, East Coast, West Coast. It don't matter. I always still want to be good at what I do. If I'm not, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
You know, so I still like to get out there. You know, kick it with the OGs, the guys I've been doing it with for decades, and then some of these younger guys that are coming in, you know, just to know I can, you know, I'm not trying to do what a younger artist does. I'm just trying to show that what a younger artist is doing now isn't as different from what we did then. It's just the words change.
Right.
The dances change, the clothes change, you know, that type of stuff. But nothing else in hip hop really changed.
Right. I like that song you guys put out, Mo Trill.
Yeah.
Y'all just shot the video for that
reason. Yeah, So doing an album like Mo Trill is really, you know, having fun again. I've been going back more to the original method of making music, which is an artist, you know, it don't have to be a rapper, but an artist locks in with one particular producer. They create a body of work together. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Songs are created and produced to complement each other and to tell a sort of a story. You know what I'm saying? So the producer gives you the soundtrack to the story. All you have to do is have enough of an imagination to make shit from the beginning to the end all kind of tie together.
Right.
And so that to me is a better way of presenting a body of work to people. That's the majority of what I did with UGK was primarily pimp, making a lot of the music, you know what I'm saying? Certain projects, all of the music. And then he and I trying to tell a story
right.
through that music and make the stories that we tell all connect and have like a common theme, you know, so.
Yeah, that's the thing I love about a lot of UGK music. It's the storylines in them because you could almost visualize it when you're listening to it. In fact, you had a song called The Story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a dope song. I like the way you spelled it out, just beginning to end. You told a whole story.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to encapsulate as much of who we were, what we were thinking, and how we went through the process of getting to where we were going. And that story was still open-ended because at that time I was writing the story to kind of put UGK's, you know, professional and personal history in proper perspective for people who may have, you know, we started in 92, but there may be some people that came in 94
mm-hmm.
or came in 96 or 99, you know, and may not understand how we got from A to B to C to D. So that song kind of laid everything out for everybody just to know, you know, where we had come from to where we were and where we were going. Because at the end of that song, it was really still about, you know, just wait till Pimp come home.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right. The shit going to be even bigger. And yeah, it actually was.
Yeah. Yeah. Now tell us, I know a lot of viewers that, you know UGK's story. They remember the record you did with Jay-Z. Mm-hmm. And there's some backstory to that because as I understand it, Chad wasn't really on board with that at the beginning, right?
Yeah, because for one, if you listen to Big Pimpin', there had never been a song that even sounded remotely like Big Pimpin'. It was a very different type of sample, very different energy. And Jay-Z at the time was one of the biggest hip-hop artists on the planet. And so I knew that this record was going to get a lot of attention. I didn't know it was going to end up being as big as it was, but I knew that just the idea of a song with Jay-Z featuring UGK produced by Timbaland was going to pique people's interest.
Right.
You know, and the fact that it was executed pretty much as good as you could have executed on that song, you know. Like, this thing is going to be a nice little record. And their original first record that they went with didn't go as big as they thought it was going to go. It was him and Mariah Carey. But it didn't really take off with people. And so they ended up moving Big Pimpin' up the timeline. Big Pimpin' was supposed to be maybe the third, fourth video. It ended up getting moved up to the second video. And it just had so much momentum behind this record. The record just kept going and going and going because the sound bed of it is more of an international record. And so it allowed, it's more world music than typical rap song. So it allowed more people culturally to be a part of the record and pique people that normally didn't have elements in a rap song that were familiar. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden something was happening and that whistle, that flute-like instrument, it really drew people in almost like a, I always call it like this hidden Pied Piper type of thing. You know what I'm saying? Right. So when you hear that little flute come, you know it's going down. I've been all over the world. Like, literally, I've been to over 50 countries around the world. And there isn't a room that I walked in that plays music that when that song plays, it doesn't have a reaction.
Right.
And every room reacts the same way. I don't care what country, what city you're in. When everybody hit Big Pimpin', it's time to turn up. That's what that song personifies. Like, we made it. Typically, you end up, when you hit Big Pimpin', you're in a room where people can show that they're successful and that they've made it. That's typically the setting that song plays in. And so it gives people an opportunity to live in the moment through the song. You know, right. And be like, shit, we in here with these bottles. We got these bad broads, whatever. We got money, clothes, the jewelry. We Big Pimpin' right now. That's kind of how records affect people and speak to people repeatedly. And Big Pimpin' is one of those records that no matter what room you're in, city or country in the world, it's balling is balling.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's a universal concept.
Right. Yeah, well, that whole album was dope, but I remember when you guys came out, you know, with that, and we were like, man, UGK is outdoing Jay-Z on that. Like, you know, we were like, they made the record.
Now, it was just good to be able to take, you know, advantage of the opportunity to do exactly what you need to do. Chad's whole problem was with the song was that because there'll be a lot of new people hearing it, that they might think that that's who we were and that was the kind of music we did. Mm-hmm. But I was always confident that people would go back and try to hear more of it. And they would be able to see through the music that we did exactly why we represented the parts of the song that we did. The shit that we talking about on the record, well, if you go back to our other music, it adds up. It's not like we talk about different shit on that record. We did just what we do. Chad couldn't have been more Chad than he was on that record. And so I felt it was a proper reflection of who we were. And eventually he came along.
Yeah, glad he did, because that definitely stepped it up. So back to 50 years of hip hop. As you reflect on hip hop over the, you know, you've been in it 30 years, 31 years, it's been around for 50 years. Did you ever anticipate hip hop being this wide, this big globally?
No, you couldn't really see that far. You know, when we started rapping, it wasn't something that you did to get rich. You could see some people were having success in it and having money, fame, and popularity, whatever, but you couldn't really tell that people were getting rich. Most people that got into rap at that time really wanted to be a part of the culture. You know, the way rappers dress, the way rappers talk, the way people in hip hop world dance, there was all of these things culturally were exciting. You know what I'm saying? So people just wanted to be a part of it. And that, you know, in the early days, we took in everything. It didn't matter who made it, where it was from. We listened to it all, but we just wanted more and more of it, you know. And now we look 50 years later, not only is hip hop still existing, still relevant, it's still impactful. I would argue that hip hop on this planet is one of the biggest parts of popular culture. Almost everything on this planet that's trying to be sold to people in a cool or hip or modern way has to employ some element of hip hop culture, if not the music, the clothes, the terminology, the dancing, the graffiti, style of writing, somewhere in that shit, movie, TV show, clothes, sneakers, all that shit, something in that something used to sell that product will be reflective or representative of hip hop culture. Otherwise, the average person won't even think it's cool or worth fucking with.
Right. Right. And that's true, because just like you, I've been in a lot of different countries, in Japan and Korea, and you see the hip hop influence in Asian countries.
Asian people dance better as far as breakdancing and hip hop than anybody. Koreans are killing it right now around here, because people are taking our culture and putting their spin on it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right. And so, and then they send it back to us, and it inspires us to look at something different, because they start presenting something that we've done traditionally one way for so long, and then you see how they doing it, like, damn, I ain't gonna lie, it's kind of live. You know what I'm saying? Hmm. Then you try to figure out what parts of that you can embrace, you know, that'll make sense, and then incorporate that. So it's all cyclical in the way that we put culture out to the world, see how people receive it, see how some people put their spin on it and give it back to us. So it's almost like if you, you know, in the old days, you break dancing against somebody, you do something and do a move and hit them, and then they do a little move and they take it a little further. And then you see what they do. You know, you pop lock and give it to somebody.
Yeah.
And then they do their thing, then they give it back to you. That's how culture works.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's supposed to be interactive. You ain't supposed to just put a picture on the wall and just look at it. You're supposed to look at it and then go and take your interpretation of the world and present it to the world. I can't draw. I can't write. So, I mean, I can't write like pretty.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So I write. I rap. I make music. That's the way I present, the way I see the world and what inspires me. That's how I present it to the world. If people see what I do, they become inspired.
Right. Right. All right. And then, so I want to talk now. I want to shift over to the business aspect of this, because one of the things you've been, congratulations, by the way, for a great 2022. I mean, you won in a lot of ways in 2022, and it was awesome to see that. But one of the things that you've been successful at is transitioning, not away from the music industry, but pivoting, I guess would be the best term, into the business world and being successful at that. As a matter of fact, millions of people, probably 8 million or more, saw you on Good Morning America with the number one burger in the country. And so congrats on that, Trill Burgers. So let's talk about Trill Burger. Let's talk about, you know, what you're doing with that. And just how have you been able to get that business acumen, that business mindset to get into that space?
Typically, when you do a job for a long time, you pick up shit that you don't even realize you're picking up on the job. For me, the one thing that I always paid attention to was there's a difference between rich people and wealthy people.
Mm-hmm.
And my thing was always, how do you go from getting rich to being wealthy? Because whether people know it or not, in terms of the grand scale of the world, it's fairly easy nowadays to get what people would consider rich. 1 million, 2 million, 5 million. Not the easiest thing in the world to do, but it's not as hard as somebody would have you believe.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? There are more millionaires, there's literally thousands of millionaires in America right now. You know, many of them of color. But it's going to take some real effort and determination to get from being rich to wealthy. And so I looked at the people that came from the culture that I was in, who got rich in rap music, the Puffies of the world, the Jay-Z's of the world, the Russell Simmons of the world. They got rich making rap music, but they got wealthy going into other businesses. Russell Simmons did advertising, did clothing. You know, Puffy did clothing, did liquor, Jay-Z the same. These people, you know, took everything they learned from the music business, not the music side, because they obviously knew that, but the more that they learned about business and the more they understood their cultural value, right? Not just about the records you sell, but the idea of you being a salesman of a product.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this burger situation come around, I say all of that to say that basically I realized that selling this burger wasn't going to be much different than selling people an album.
Okay.
that. The main difference being that when I make an album and sell it, I only got to sell it one time for people to enjoy. So I come to your city, I make a big thing about it, bring a bunch of attention to the album, do a couple of songs, you hear the album, you buy it, my job is done. With the burger, I got to sell that bitch every time. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Every time you want a burger, I'm really, my company's on the line. Every time you eat a burger, my reputation's on the line. You know what I'm saying? So I don't have to be just good that one time on that song. Like when I'm in the studio, it may take me a couple of times to get it, but once I get it, I got it. We sell it, I'm done with that song. This burger, I got to get right every motherfucking time.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? My last burger is either my best burger or my worst burger. Yeah. That's how we look at it. Everything that come off the line, make or break this company. You know what I'm saying? So, and I didn't really know anything about the food industry, but I knew how to sell a product. Mm-hmm. All I had to do was get the product in front of people, let people listen to me talk about the product, and convince them to try the product. Once they try it, I'm good. We good money. You know what I'm saying? So it really just became about taking all the elements in terms of selling an album, right? Convincing somebody to sign me as an artist. Convincing a label to sign us as a company. Convincing people to buy tickets to a concert, buy t-shirts, buy an album. All of this is sales, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And my pitch is airtight, you know what I'm saying? And my reputation is solid. You know, I've got 30 years of real-time, real-world experience selling a product to people, you know what I'm saying? And because of that, there's a level of faith and trust that I've built up with people. So immediately, I already knew the people that trust me to present them with music are going to, you know, at least give me consideration to try the burger.
Right.
So we're going to start there. You know, let's try to put the burger in front of people that already fuck with me. Mm-hmm. We accomplished that. Now we try to put it in a mixed space of people. Let's bring the burger somewhere where a lot of people will fuck with me. You know what I'm saying? And they'll be with other people. That's where the idea of music festivals came in. See, the burger became an album. So for an album to become successful, you got to go on the road. You got to go on promo too. So that's what we did. We took the burger on a promo too.
That's your pop-ups.
Right? You know what I'm saying? No, that's when I go to music festivals.
Oh, okay.
You know what
I'm saying?
But typically the pop-ups, yeah, because when you're a young artist, you got to start local. That's the pop-ups. Then you go on the road with it. That's me cooking at Coachella, me cooking at Rock the Bells, me cooking at Rolling Loud, me cooking at Something in the Water. You know what I'm saying? All these different music festivals, we taking it on tour. We doing meet and greets. You know what I'm saying? Meeting the people. Now the people like the burger. Now word gets out the burger's legitimate. That's how we end up getting on Good Morning America. And the contest, that's your Grammy nomination.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Then we won Best Burger in America. That's winning the Grammy. Now, in terms of us having to pay to get in the rooms, because when you are up and coming artist, you got to pay to get on the show.
Right.
You don't just get on the show. So you got to pay to sell food at Coachella. You got to pay to sell food at Rolling Loud, at Rock the Bell, at all these different places. Now, because the burger has prestige, my burger is the shit. Like, just like you got the number one song out there. Now, people pay me to bring the burger.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It don't cost me no more. We're not getting in the van no more. Now they flying us out.
Right.
For the burger. And so I just made it work in that sense. But it was always about knowing the value of the product. If you know your shit is jamming, you know what I'm saying? Then you hold out and you try to put your music in the best possible position to be successful. Same thing with the burger. I knew that bitch was good to go. I just had to position it right. So I used all the people I knew and all the places that I already had energy in to put the burger in that space, get it in front of people that already fuck with me, and just use word of mouth like music is word of mouth.
Right. That's a corporate strategy that could be used.
Yeah, no, this is a 30-year plan. This is not a, you know, 4 or 5 year little something that we're going to go do something else. No, I expect this burger to live way longer than me.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's wealth, generational wealth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's how you go from being rich to being wealthy.
Right. Right. That's dope. And that's something that a lot of people watching this, a lot of young entrepreneurs that are trying to get something going, listen to what he's saying. Follow that kind of plan where you grind regular, just hard grind, you know, every day, just like you used to sell tapes or something out your trunk.
If you've been to a pop-up and you've seen me, I'm out there sweating just like anybody else. You know what I'm saying? I'm not at home sitting on my sofa in my drawers in front of TV calling, talking about how's it going? How's it looking out there? Okay, well, keep me informed, keep me posted. I know that me being a part of the experience is the experience for people. Yeah, people want to come and try the burger and support me, but in the back of your mind, you're like, man, but he might actually be there. You know what I'm saying? And if they get that I'm actually there, that makes it a deeper experience for people. It resonates deeper, you know what I'm saying? Because them lines be long. You know what I'm saying? That wait is rough, but the burger is worth it, especially if you get there and then it's Bun B handing your burger to people, to you. You know what I'm saying? People go to Michael Jordan Steakhouse in Chicago all the time. Why do you go? Because you, in the back of your mind, you hoping maybe Michael Jordan might be there. You go to Escobar in Atlanta. Why? In the back of your mind, you hoping 2 Chainz might be there. Right. You know what I'm saying? And I've been to Escobar with 2 Chainz was there. You know? So I want people to have that experience with me. Now, as this brand grows, we get 4, 5, 6. I'm not going to be able to be at every place all the time. Right. But never be surprised if a Trill Burger on sale and I pop up. Don't even just be surprised about that. Right. Just assume that was going to happen.
And you got a spot, right?
Yeah. It should be open, I would say, by the first week of April.
Okay.
Just to all be right. safe. Coming because doing soon. Yeah, because we got to cook at the rodeo, too. And that's going to take a lot because the rodeo is typically, you know, 2 hours of prep, 12 hours of operation, you know, 10 to 12 hours of selling burgers back to back to back. The last day of the rodeo last year, we did 1,200 burgers that day. And we didn't have half the pub and hype that we got around the burger now. So we expect them to do 1,200 to 1,500 at least a day this time. We got a bigger setup. We got a better position to get people in and out, which is designed to sell more burgers. But then that means you some cooking motherfuckers at the time, you know. And I really appreciate the people that work for me and the work they got to do. So I just try to give them the best conditions possible to be productive at their job.
Right. And speaking of the rodeo, I mean, last year was phenomenal. Congrats on that. That takeover was just, it was out of this world. And then this year, you're coming back. So you got burgers going. You got your night at the rodeo. So what can we expect from that? Can you give us any details?
Well, I mean, last year was the H-Town takeover, which is really like a love letter to the city and everybody that helped put Houston hip hop where it's at. But you can't do the same show every time.
Right.
You don't want to get stuck in trying to recreate things and, you know, catch lightning in a bottle one time, you know, and then you try to move on. And there's a lot of other great music that we've all collectively experienced. So with this year, the Southern Takeover, we're going to try to find the same music that we love in Houston and make us feel a certain way. There's music like that that people make in Louisiana. There's music like that that people make in Tennessee and other great places in the South. And so I can't recreate what we did last year, but I can recreate that feeling of how it felt for everybody in the room to be on the same shit. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
When you come to my Bun B's Takeover, you know, whatever bullshit you on, you gotta leave that outside. It don't work in the room. So if you black and you don't like white people, you don't come to the rodeo. The white people gonna be at the rodeo.
Right.
If you white, you like black, don't like black people, don't come to the rodeo because they gonna be there. If you don't like gay people, don't come. They finna come and turn up. So whoever it is that you don't like, they probably gonna be at the rodeo. So you got to leave the bullshit outside in order to come inside. Right. And we encourage people when they leave, don't pick the bullshit back up.
Right.
Because if we can all enjoy each other in that room like that on that night, on that day, we could really do that every day.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? We just got to remind ourselves that we really fuck with the same shit more than we don't, in theory, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's real. And it's just like sporting events. I mean, you know, you go to a game, whatever, football, basketball game, you don't like whatever. You don't like white people and a white person sitting next to you, your team do something, everybody cheering.
I don't care who it is. You know, you could damn near be sitting next to Greg Abbott at an Astros game. And if Alvarez hit a home run, you fuck around and high five Greg Abbott in that moment. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's just how group setting is and how mob mentality works. And typically, the person that's not on that is the person that everybody's like, boo, get him the fuck out of here.
Right.
So that's how I feel at the rodeo. If you ain't really with it, if you're not really at least trying to have an open mind about the shit, don't even come. Because you're going to have a bad night and you're probably going to end up fucking up the people next to you night. Like, we doing the Cupid Shuffle at the rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
So damn near everybody on the road got to kind of be on the same page, or you got to start explaining to the people, okay, look, just follow me. Watch what we do. He going to tell you what to do and just do it. Just follow us, you know. We're going to go to the right full time. We're going to go to the, you know, that's what's going to happen, because you're not going to want people to fuck up the Cupid Shuffle on your road.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So if you're going, you know, I tell all the wives, if you're going with your husband, you know your husband can't dance, y'all need to, this weekend, y'all need to be practicing. You know what I'm saying? Y'all need to be rehearsing it. You know what I'm saying? It's not like you got to do a whole TikTok video. It's very, very simple. But we're going to have some. But that's the kind of fun I want to have. That's the kind of experience I want people to have. People going to come in and be like, damn, this was fun.
Right.
This was fun. The main thing about the rodeo that I heard from everybody last year was that they never sat down. Mm-hmm. That was the one thing I heard more than everybody say. Any other element, some people like to slap. Some people like the singing. Some people like this, like that. But everybody was like, man, we danced the whole time. Everybody. Because there are people that come to this that, you know, like if you're writing a review of the rodeo, right? A lot of press, people got to come there and do a review of every concert. And it's country, pop, country, Tejano, country. You know, but so many of the nights, you know, they all roll over into like damn the same thing. You just there writing, drink, talk, go home, turn there, right? The rodeo is different. Like people actually heard songs in a certain way. They saw slabs on the dirt. It was a whole night of shit that really people had no idea they was really gonna be able to experience, you know, and it really brought the city together. So I'm trying to do that the best I can. Some of these songs are bigger national hits than others.
Right.
But they all in Houston, that's my thing. I'm trying to have songs that it was the shit here.
Right.
I don't care if it was big in LA. I don't care if it was big in New York. Cupid Shuffle ain't no, that's here.
Right.
That's for, and the Cupid Shuffle ain't even really for me. That's for my mom or my auntie them. I'm trying to make sure that everybody in the room have something they can connect to.
That's
something that makes sense. You don't want your mama there and a bunch of people cussing, grabbing their dick all night. You know what I'm saying? Right. Your mama want to be, oh, shit, hold up, baby. That's my song right there. That's what the rodeo is about because it's always been generational.
Right.
Nobody just go by themselves. You go with your mama. You introduce to it through your mama. There. You get older, you bring your mama and you bring your kids to the rodeo. I had my kid, my grandchildren, and my mama. I had four generations in my suite. Wow. And everybody enjoyed something from the show. That's how we look at the rodeo, trying to make sure that everybody at some point, you know, even the Cowboys, goddamn, that's my song right there. I need everybody at some point to feel like something was for them.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Now, it was easy to do that when everything was Houston.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit harder this time around, but I think we got it.
All right. What night is yours?
March 3rd, Black Heritage
Day. March 3rd. So those that are listening, if you're not in the Houston area, come on through to the rodeo on March the 3rd. Check out Buns Takeover. It's going to be lit. I plan on being there. I'm sure a lot of you that are watching plan on coming through and supporting.
Yeah, I hope you make it. Get your burger before you go in.
For sure. Hey, all right. We going to wrap up in just a minute, but I got something fun I want to do with you. I got to put my timer on. And I'm going to give you five subjects.
Okay.
And you got to give me your top five. I'm just going to name the subject. You're going to give me your top five. It's going to be players. It's going to be people, that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's a five for five, so we got 5 minutes to run through it.
All right.
Let me pull up my little timer, start it up. All right. So the first one I want to go with is your top five NBA players of all time.
Top five NBA players of all time. All right. I'm an old school, so I'm going to say Dominique Wilkins.
Okay.
I'm going to say Sean Kemp. Vince Carter. Allen Iverson, and number one, obviously, Hakeem Olajuwon.
Okay, all right.
I'm an old head, though. I ain't going to say Steve Curry. Steph Curry and all these dudes, they still got some work to do.
All right.
They killing it, but you know, to get in my top five, you got a little more work to do.
All right.
Honorable mention, of course, Steven Jackson.
Steven Jackson, yeah. Shout out to Captain Jack for sure. Let's go to the NFL. Mm. I'm not going to go your top five players of all time. Let's go top five running backs of all time.
Okay. Arian Foster.
Okay.
Marshall Faulk.
Okay.
Eric Dickerson. Barry Sanders. And, of course, I'm from Houston, Earl Campbell.
Earl Campbell, all right. All right. And your honorable mention?
Mm.
Can we go home for that one?
Yeah, yeah. I guess all honorable mentions gonna be for PA.
Shout out to Jamal Charles.
But, man, I just saw him, and, you know, he had, like, a whole autograph signing lately, you know, like, watching him and Dante Hall live through these Chiefs championships, man, it's been real beautiful, you know what I'm saying, because the organization welcomes him back with open arms. I mean, Jamal had a line, people come and get autographs and shit to see him. There's a lot of tradition in that city, and so they deserve these championships,
right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But the organization do right. That's always been my problem with the Texans is that, you know, for example, we can't celebrate Earl Campbell the way Earl Campbell's supposed to be celebrated, right? Because the owner of this team was not the owner when Earl was here. And we technically, like, he never played for the Texans. So to put him in a ring of honor and NRG doesn't work. And he never played for the Titans. So putting him in the ring of honor in Tennessee don't work. So my thing is, we've got to find some way to honor these people in the right way. Now, you know, Jamal and Tay, they lucky because same team, same city, all these things are still working. But, you know, I hate that Earl Campbell, we haven't found the proper way to give Earl Campbell his flowers in Houston.
Right.
Now, I proposed doing it whenever the Texans play the Titans for a home game, because you got both organizations, and it should be some kind of way to honor Earl Campbell in the football stadium in Houston, like everybody else gets honored.
You know? Right.
We can't retire his jersey or nothing like that, but at least we can honor the contributions of Earl Campbell to the city of Houston the same way we honor Bum Phillips in the city of Houston. You know what I'm saying? I think we should be able to honor Earl Campbell too.
Yeah, I'm with that. Yeah, Earl was like, I mean, he was a workhorse. And for those our age, my age, we remember him running that ball like it was nothing.
Yeah.
He was doing it.
And that's why I don't want it to seem like Jamal didn't deserve to be in the top five.
Yeah.
I don't believe that Jamal got a chance to really have a full body of work.
Right.
You know, he had a couple of unfortunate injuries that didn't allow him to have as long a body of work as he could have. But, I mean, shit, just on speed alone.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Just on speed alone.
When he was in high school, I was a referee, and I remember trying to keep up with him going down the sidelines. Just like, yeah.
That'd be like, something. You'd be there tripped up and hurt your goddamn self trying to catch up with
pulling hamstrings and everything. It was like, it wasn't going to work.
But that's why I mentioned both of them, because if Jamal and Dante Hall, both of them, if either one of them caught that corner, it was a wrap. You wouldn't catch him.
Yeah.
You know, Jamal was a lot more slick through the middle. Dante, because he was small.
Mm.
But Jamal was a power runner. You know what I'm saying? And once he got the first couple of steps, it was over.
Jamal always reminded me of Eric Dickerson a lot.
Yeah.
In the way that he ran.
He was almost like you look at, like, nowadays you have a lot of, you know, like, receivers that are also running backs
right.
out of the backfield that right. can actually take that ball off. And that comes with power. You know what I'm saying? That comes with power.
Yeah.
That's the only way you can, a wide receiver can be really productive in right. that running back slot.
Like
really,
it's about power.
Yep. Debo is the perfect example right. of a wide receiver who can take the ball in the backfield and actually make a play out of it. That's power running.
Right.
You know, right. Most wide receivers, they're not that. They're better in stride.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They're better off the ball.
Right. Let's go social activists, top five.
Wow, top five social activists. Okay. That's a great question. Angela Davis.
Okay.
Huey P. Newton.
Right.
Fred Hampton. Malcolm X. Martin Luther King.
All right. That's a top five nobody can argue with right there. And then the last one. No, I got two more.
Yeah. How much time we got on the clock? We still good?
Yeah, we good. We
make
good.
Sure
I had to extend it.
And make sure we got to kick it up a little bit. My bad. Nah, I get long-winded like a mother.
We good, man. Top five movies.
Oh, man. That's a good one right there. That is a good one. Top five movies. For for me personally, this is just me. Mm-hmm. Car wash.
Okay.
Cooley High.
All right.
Friday. Minister Society. Scarface.
Okay. All right. That's a dope top five.
Now we. I've always been in the movies. That's why, like, yeah. I try to explain to younger generation about who Richard Pryor really was, and people don't really get it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's something you kind of had to live through.
Yeah.
But people don't really feel.
Well, man, I was with Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby and Sidney Poitier. Them was my dudes. You know.
Well, I was gonna say Which Way Is Up, yeah. But nobody definitely don't know about that type of shit. They got a Google car wash. They're gonna think I'm talking about Dr. Dre and Snoop around.
Yeah. All right, last category. This is your category. Top five rappers of all time.
Oh, this is easy. This is very easy. Big Daddy Kane.
All right.
Kool G Rap. KRS-One. Scarface. MC.
All right.
That's super easy.
Yeah.
That's super easy.
That's dope. Hey, that's all we got, folks. That's it. We're going to wrap up here in a minute. I want to thank Bun for taking time to be out here. We got
thank you. Bro. Shout out to my boy Daylight for hooking this up.
Yeah.
Y'all go to Humidor, PA, and smoke something with
it. That's just what I was about to say, man. Check out his business down in PA, the Cigar Lounge. My boy Big Ruck, my writing partner, is in the studio. Appreciate him being here. DTA, Dream Team Alliance. We got some films coming your way, so stay tuned for that. Shout out to Jordan, our cinematographer, and to Jerry, whose studio we're using. We appreciate you.
Dreamlight Productions, baby. Tap in.
Man, we appreciate you, Bun, man. We're proud to say we're from the same city with you. I'm proud to say that I shook your hand, man. I'm really pleased to meet you. I like the vibe that you give off. I like everything you've been doing. I'm supporting you 100%. We got 14 countries watching us on the Dadcast podcast. And of those 14 countries, I'm telling everybody, get you a Trill burger. I got to get me a veggie burger, man. I dropped meat.
We got so veggie. I got you. It's going to take. You want, I'm going to tell you, typically when vegans eat our vegan burger, they get scared.
Okay.
They get very scared because they believe we gave them the wrong burger. It happens every time.
Oh, yeah?
They be like, man, you gave me the beef, bro. You gave me the beef. It's not. I'm telling you, we have, you know, my chefs, Mike Farm and Nando, they really put their foot in their ass into this food. And I'm telling you, I feel like the vegan Trill burger is a bigger deal than the beef Trill burger because it's a lot, you got more of a chance making a beef burger that could compete with my beef burger than you do a vegan burger fucking with my vegan burger. My beef burger is a 10, the closest thing to it might be an 8.5.
All right.
My vegan burger is a 10, closest thing to that might be a 2-3 tops. Oh, like, man. It's a game. My vegan burger is a bigger game changer than any other burger we have in Austin.
Count me in, man. I got to get that.
No, you got to get that. The problem is I hate the fact that when people get this burger, they, you know, right now they can't get it when they want it. That's been the biggest thing because after you eat a Trill burger, it fuck up every other hamburger experience for you. And like with my wife will wake up in the morning and want a Trill burger and know that she can't get one. And it fuck your day up. Your day don't even start right. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But soon enough, 3607 South Shepherd in Richmond, baby. Trill burger's coming soon.
All right. Y'all support, man. Again, man, we appreciate you. And
happy to be here.
For the Dadcast podcast, I'm your boy Lavelle. We're signing out. We'll catch you next time. Look for season 5 coming soon. Peace.